Hello, listeners. Jess Irvine here, economics writer, grabbing the microphone this week for a very special episode of Please Explain. We are out of the studio today and currently camped in the front foyer of Westpac Bank's Sydney head office. Why? Well, when I heard that the Reserve Bank had slashed Australia's official cash rate again to below 1%, there was only one man I wanted to talk to. His name is Bill Evans, and he's been the chief economist here at Westpac since 1991. In July, he was the first economist from the Big Four banks to predict today's rate cut. Obviously, by cutting interest rates today, our central bank is hoping to stimulate the economy and get more Australians into jobs by making it cheaper for businesses to borrow and invest. But there is also a flip side to today's decision. By making it cheaper for households to borrow, there are now fears that rate cuts will reignite Australia's property price boom, locking even more young Australians out of home ownership. And indeed, data from CoreLogic released this week show home prices in both Sydney and Melbourne have already rebounded by 1.7% in September. So I'm here to ask Bill Evans to please explain what is going on and where we can expect interest rates to head from here. Hi, Bill. Good to see you. Thanks for taking some time today to help our listeners explain what's going on with interest rates. And first of all, congratulations to you. I don't know how modest or immodest you are to point out that you were the first of the Big Four bank economists to tip that we would get a rate cut this week. Were you a bit relieved today that that actually came through? How did you feel to be right?
Yeah, Jessica, this one was a particularly a good one for me because if I go back through history, about 4 years ago when the current governor was deputy governor, I asked him a question where I, in a public forum, and I said, how low do you think interest rates can go? Up below what level will they become ineffective? He said, I think about 1%. So that was a sort of a psychological flaw that the market and commentators had because it got quite a lot of exposure at the time, as you would expect. So back on the 24th of May, we decided that that 1% was nothing sacred. And given the direction the economy was heading for and given the fact that the Reserve Bank had now entered into an easing cycle, even though they hadn't cut yet, we knew they were going to cut in June and then there was a follow-up in July. We said, well, look, why should 1% be the floor? So on the 24th of May, we were the only forecaster amongst the 25 forecasters that register in the polls that said rates could go under 1%. So I was pretty pleased today to see that that was actually justified. Now, by the time we came to today, the traders had about an 80% probability that they would cut. And so it wasn't that big a surprise today. But over the course of the last few months, as we moved towards that target, we were quite pleased to see that our forecast was coming true.
Yeah. Now, can we just explain for people why the Reserve Bank thinks that this will work? They've been cutting, and we haven't been getting the results that they wanted necessarily, or at least that's how it can look from the outside. What faith can people have that cuts today will actually lead people to spend more tomorrow?
Well, I think they have two key mechanisms that they rely upon when assessing the value of cutting rates. The first one is their analysis indicates that, as we know, when rates get cut, deposit rates go down and lending rates go down. And their analysis is that the cash flow improvement that borrowers get tends to be spent more than the cash flow improvement that, say, a depositor gets. So they think that lower rates will always mean that net-net you'll see more spending in the economy. The other factor that's very important in this cycle is the fact that global rates are so low. And Australia, being a small open economy that is reliant upon a competitive exchange rate, if we weren't to follow rates down, that would put unnecessary upward pressure on the Aussie dollar. And that, of course, would impact upon our exports, particularly around the services sector, which has been a really important growth factor for us, tourists, students and that. So the lower Aussie dollar is important as well. So they're the two channels that they believe still work. And whenever you say, but it hasn't helped, there's always a counterfactual. What would have happened if they hadn't have cut rates? If we were still sitting at 1.5% and the Federal Reserve in the US has now embarked upon a rate cutting cycle, Japan has negative rates. Europe has negative rates. New Zealand has cut their rates aggressively. If we were to be sitting there at 1.5%, what might that mean for the exchange rate and the impact upon a small open economy? So that's always the problem with people that go, oh, it hasn't helped. You don't know what would have happened if you hadn't have done it.
Do you think there is a risk, though, that with, you know, we used to think 1% would be a very low rate and we couldn't go below there, that people just sort of get the message that something is wrong and there's an impact on confidence, that people, you know, feel like there's extraordinary measures, we're below 1%, where are we heading from here, that has a confidence impact?
Some folks might be thinking that there'll be a follow-up cut in November, because the statement that was released today was quite dovish, indicating that they've opened the door for more cuts. So some folks might say they might go in November. But what we saw when they went consecutively in June and July was that our consumer sentiment index, the Westpac Consumer Sentiment Index, which is a sort of the gold standard for how consumers feel, that fell by more than 4%. So you had rate cuts and yet sentiment fell. And I think that was the point you were making, was that consumers said, well, wait a minute, why are they needing to cut 2 months in a row? That's unusual. And so maybe there's something wrong. But what we saw was that when they paused in August, sentiment recovered back to a more normal level. So I think it is true that consecutive cuts tend to undermine people's confidence. But a gradual move down, I don't think, should have that same impact.
Now, the message is, it's cheaper to borrow, go out and borrow. We've already seen house prices start to turn last month, with people expecting, I guess, that it would be cheaper to borrow and interest rates are going down. What do you think will happen to house prices now that we're seeing these cuts coming through for people? That means it's going to push up house prices, I presume. Is that your call?
Yes, it's our forecast that Sydney-Melbourne house prices will lift by around 12% from the low in May to the end of next year. They've increased by 3 or 4% so far. I would think another 2 or 3% this year and then another 6% next year.
Which pretty much gives you back all the fall that we saw in those capital cities.
Gives you back a fair bit of it, yes. That's not the only story about housing. The more disturbing story about housing is what's happening on housing construction. And we've got this oversupply of high-rise looming, where high-rise completions are now running well ahead of population growth. There's concerns in the building of new houses as well. So it's quite a concern for growth in the economy that construction cycle that's been such a major supporter of the economy for the last few years is going to be a substantial drag for the next few years. So the housing story isn't just about prices, it's also about construction. It would be my view that because the housing recovery is starting from a fairly high base this time, you won't get the total boom in house prices that we saw back in 14, 15, 16, 17. But I'm certainly comfortable with the view that house prices will turn. From the Reserve Bank's perspective, if they want the economy to improve, then you've got to expect house prices to be rising as well.
This is sort of the deliberate strategy, as much as potential first home buyers may be frustrated by that. This is actually the strategy, isn't it? That if we don't want house prices to fall too far, we want them to go up, and that will give people the wealth effect. Do you think that is something that the Reserve Bank is directly trying to engineer, is some end to those price falls?
No, I think there may have been a point maybe at the end of last year where new lending for housing fell by 15%. In 6 months, which was extraordinary. And Sydney and Melbourne house prices fell around 3.5% over November and December. I think there may have been a concern then that there was something happening in the housing market that could have got out of control. But since then, certainly things have stabilised and prices have lifted. So I don't think they're too concerned about that issue. The wealth effect, there's quite a debate around that as to whether it is that important. The Reserve Bank's concern at the moment is more around not their housing capital, but around their human capital. Their concern is that households are realising that the value of their human capital is much less than they expected.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that you get rewarded for your human capital in wages.
Yes.
And if you thought that your human capital was worth a wage rise of around 4% a year, which was the standard, you would be adopting certain spending policies, certain borrowing approaches. If you suddenly have to come to terms with the fact that it's only generating a 2% wage rise, then you're going to have to substantially change your outlook to debt and to spending. And I think that's what's working through the system at the moment. So while we can expect to see rising house prices, I don't think that household debt's going to get out of control. Yeah. I think the turnover numbers won't be sufficient to generate that sort of a boost.
Do you think we're getting the optimal strategy here? We've got interest rates being the main lever through which we're trying to engineer some sort of a turnaround in the economy. The Reserve Bank governor himself has been saying it would kind of help us if the federal government would maybe, you know, at least be less contractionary in the force that it's putting on the economy by getting back into surplus. Maybe it's time to spend some more money. Do you think it would be a better policy mix if the federal government was sloshing around a bit more money? And if so, what would you do if you were the federal government?
Yeah, it does look a bit strange, doesn't it, that you've got a cash rate of 0.75 and you've got a budget surplus. Normally you would associate a cash rate of that level with a budget deficit. But let's look around the world. Look at Germany. They've got a budget surplus of 1.5% of GDP. And they've got minus 0.5 on their overnight cash rate. So it's something that happens in some countries. I think the government is very much committed to delivering that surplus in 1920. They just missed it in 1819. And that was a major election promise. And I think they're committed to delivering on their election promises. So until they can be absolutely certain that this 1920 surplus is in the bag, I think they'll be cautious in terms of what else they might do. They do have a range of options. The big picture infrastructure program, I don't think, is not going to provide the sort of boost to demand in the short term. You need environmental approvals. You need to find the right suppliers to generate the big new projects. But they can certainly put money out, say, in raising the benefits from existing infrastructure. So, for instance, maintenance and repairs that can be paid through local governments. Because we know that our infrastructure is ageing and the productivity could be lifted through that. I think they could also look at ways in which the money could get quickly into the economy. Maybe New Start should be reconsidered. They've had their big tax cuts this year. I suspect it'll be some time before they move away from that program that they've got for another set of tax cuts that'll introduce another $15 billion into the economy on top of the $8 billion, but that's a few years away. So I think there's options. But they need to firstly be confident that they can deliver that budget surplus. And let's face it, that things can move around quickly. A few months ago, we were talking about an iron ore price of $120. It's now down to $90. We've had similar changes in coal prices, and they can have direct impacts upon the budget. So I think the government has every intention to provide a boost to demand, but we'll have to wait a little while before they feel confident enough to do that.
And in the meantime, we're sort of left with interest rates as the main lever. Has the decision this week or the wording in the statement this week changed your call at all about where you think interest rates are heading from here? Because I think you had another interest rate cut penciled in for February. Are you changing that view or are you sticking with that?
No, that's our view. Bear in mind that view was adopted on the 24th of July, so some time ago, and most other people have been moving their views around quite a lot over the last few months. So these things always remain under consideration. But there's only two more meetings. As I said, the likelihood of another move in November looks very low, given what we saw in June, July. So the only other time that they could move would be in December. But we're comfortable with February.
I think NAB has them going before Christmas. So you've missed your opportunity to be the next guy who's called the next interest rate if that happens before Christmas. Do you think there would be any doubt in the governor's mind of not wanting to start on a rapid fire set of rate cuts from here? Is that why you're thinking they will wait and slow down the pace a little bit because it will scare people before Christmas?
Well, they waited 2 months in August and September, and there are a lot of folks that were expecting an earlier move than that. And so I think as you get further into the cycle, particularly given that you've got such limited firepower left, I think you might be fairly careful as to how you use that. And then, of course, we have the whole issue around unconventional policies and how far down the track they are on those. What we hear at the moment is that they're really only looking at maybe asset purchases. Maybe buying bonds, government bonds. The bond yield curve is already really, really flat. In other words, the gap between the overnight cash rate, the expected one, and the bond rate is only around now about 0.5. That's very flat. So if the government was to get into that market, the RBA was to get into that market and buy more bonds, it's unlikely they'd be able to bring that down much at all. So unconventional policies at this stage don't look as if they're going to be able to have much of an impact. But I'm sure they're looking at all sorts of options.
And if you stood up and asked the governor the same question of what's sort of the lowest that interest rates could go from here, is it zero or is it something negative? Do you think that we would ever see the cash rate go negative in this country?
I think negative cash rates are very damaging. We only need to look at Europe to see what happened. So the theory behind the negative cash rates was to say to the banks, look, if you have spare liquidity and you lodge it with the central bank, it's going to be at a negative rate. So it's going to be a tax on you. So you should go out and lend as much of the liquidity as you've got. So initially that worked. So the banks did lend the money out, but they got to a point where the people that wanted to borrow the money were unacceptable credits. And the people that the banks wanted to lend to either didn't want to borrow or had cheaper alternatives. So the money ended up being lodged back with the central bank. And it's turned out to be a tax on banks. The other reason that the European system claims the benefit of the negative rates is to bring the euro down. And that undoubtedly has been a factor because Europe's a much more open economy, say, than the US. So a lower euro generally benefits them. It's my view that the benefit of getting the Aussie dollar down with negative rates isn't as great as the distortion that you would create in the financial system with negative rates. So I don't think they'll go down that route.
So what's the lowest it will go to? 0.5% or 0.25%, and then they can think about unconventional measures like the buying of bonds? Or at what point do we need to have that conversation about?
Our view in July was that they'd go to 0.5% and then they'd look at unconventional. Or they may indeed thought that they might have had a combined policy, go to 0.5% and supplement that with some unconventional that would make the policy more effective. That's still a possibility. Would they go to 0%? Well, I think that gets back to global rates again, because our view is that the Fed has a lot further to go. The Federal Reserve has further to go. We think that they've got 4 more rate cuts to go between now and the end of next year, which would have the Federal Reserve, the federal funds rate, down below 1%. But that's not in the context of a recession in the US. That's just the US growing below trend and them still being below on their inflation target. If the US was to go into a sort of deep recession that they've had in their 3 previous recessions, I have no doubt that the Fed would go to 0%, and that may tempt the RBA to go all that way to 0%. But I think without the Fed going to 0%, I don't think the RBA would feel comfortable going to 0%.
And so we're sticking with the February next rate call, although I do read recently that you are a betting man and you do like the races and the honorary treasurer of the Australian Turf Club. So would you have a bet on a Melbourne Cup Day rate cut?
It certainly won't be my forecast. There's odds for anything, Jessica, but I would think they'd have to be, for me to take that one on, they'd have to be extraordinarily long odds.
Excellent. Thanks for taking some time to talk us through some of that today.
Thanks, Jessica.
That was Bill Evans, Chief Economist at Westpac. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, and to support independent journalism, search subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by David Estcourt and Yuji Shimada. Technical assistance by David McMillan. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening.